This podcast is presented by Celery.com, the one-stop shop e-commerce logistics provider.
There's a lot of cliches, and I'm about to say stuff now that you probably see on those like posters where a cat's hanging from a bar or something. You do, in fact, become more of who you are from the hardships or failures in your life than you do from the things that just kind of were easier. I like to talk about inviting failure into your life. And I sometimes will say, like, imagine a life in which you invited failure into your home every day.
Welcome to Celery Talks. This is a show that features ideas and the stories that are behind them. And I'm your host, Tad Kelsey. Calvin Carter had always been entrepreneurial. If you don't believe me, the dating service he started on his parents' Macintosh computer at the age of 9 might help convince you of that. After college, he attempted to work for a large corporation. However, this didn't last long because, in his words, his entrepreneurial tendencies took over. These tendencies led to many entrepreneurial successes as well as failures. He reached a turning point in 2008 when a keynote speech by Steve Jobs would change his life forever. Apple announced the opening of the App Store, and nearly instantaneously, Calvin started his mobile app development company, Bottle Rocket. In year one, he and a handful of contracted developers would limp along to create 8 apps. Despite the uncertainty, Calvin kept pushing. In 2009, NPR hired Bottle Rocket to develop their mobile app, which changed the vision and trajectory of the company. People might think, well, you were making your own apps, you know, you were going through some turbulation, fighting to continue to grow, and then all of a sudden pivot, NPR, ESPN, you started to develop for other companies. People might be tempted to go, well, you know, there were no other issues for him. What was the most difficult challenge moving ahead for you?
Well, you know, a small company that scales real fast, and I'd say for our first, we're going to be 10 years old in March. Save the date, everybody. But like for the first like 5 or 6 years, something like that, probably at least the first six years, we did a roughly 100% CAGR. So that's compounded annual growth rate. So essentially it means we doubled every year. When you double from like a million to 2 million or from 2 to 4, that's one thing. But when you double from 5 to 10, like 10 to 20, those are big damn moves. Or at least I felt they were big moves. So there are challenges along the way. One of the biggest challenges is cash flow. You know, again, I didn't have investors. All I had was a revolving line of credit that wasn't even that big. I had a great relationship with my banker who really trusted me. So my banker did everything they could to make sure that I could always pay my bills and pay my debts. We never missed or delayed any payroll ever in the history of the business, which, believe it or not, a lot of small privately owned companies do from time to time, no fault of their own, many times just because, you know, some clients use their small company vendors as financing, meaning they don't pay their bills on time, which is essentially like getting a loan, right? So when we had really large clients, it was really unusual for technology disruption allows this. You had teeny little companies like Bottle Rocket working for massive companies like Disney, Amex, you know, you name it. And our cash needs don't usually line up with the payment policies of these larger organizations. And cash flow was one of the big pucker moments for me because I never wanted to not deliver on a promise to the people that had picked up the Bottle Rocket flag to carry it into battle. So that was one thing. I'd say the other thing is just how the culture changes over time. You know, there's several, if not handfuls of moments where a rocketeer that was early on in the organization either could not or chose not to scale with the organization. And those were just tough emotional times when, you know, someone who worked so hard that you worked alongside with, and they worked so hard and you worked so hard and you did great things together, But if the business is growing at a certain pace and that person didn't sign up for that, it's just kind of hard to have those moments to have to say goodbye or get told goodbye because it just didn't work out. Those are some of the tougher things that I can think of. Because for me, business is very personal. I don't say things like, oh, hey, listen, it's not personal, it's just business. I think that's BS. I think business is, if not can be, one of the most personal things in your life. And so for me, I choose for it to be very personal. And then I think probably the third thing is being able to figure out what's the most important thing to your business, but change that over time. If you hold on to the same thing for too long, it turns into dogma. And the reason you held on to it initially is not so valid. And so it's holding you back. At some point, you've got to decide what are the core things that you'll never change. What are your core values? What's your core purpose? What are the rocks that you will never put down? Like, let's say, innovation or quality or running. Well, actually, you know, this is an interesting one. I was about to say profitable business, but in the first 5-6 years, it really didn't matter how profitable we are. I just kept plunging any penny we made back into the business. So I was less interested in profit and I was more interested in revenue scale. But there becomes a certain point where if you don't have profit, you don't have margin. And if you don't have margin, you don't have any security, you don't have any buffer point, any flexibility if anything goes wrong, but also you don't have the ability to start investing in your future, like setting up training programs, which you don't need when you only have 20 or 30 people, but you do need if you're going to have 200, or set up better processes around releasing software at scale. If we're launching, I should know this, but I think if you combined everything that we did last year, I'm going to guess and say we shipped 200 pieces of software. 200 pieces of software. May have been the very first app for Coca-Cola or Starwood or Marriott or whatever, or it could have been the 13th update to the Southwest Airlines app. Whatever it is, it's still a piece of software that we're compiling, testing, shrink wrapping, and sending. And when you're doing 10 or 20 versus 200, you need completely different processes, completely different tools, and completely different technologies that you use. And let's just call that growing pains. Changing what is the most important thing over time is important. If not, you'll hold on to the old stuff that doesn't matter anymore. It'll be dogma, and it'll stand in front of your ability to grow.
What has happened that you didn't expect to happen?
I'd say, if you go all the way back to the beginning, I did not see the app economy. I did not think there were going to be, what did Apple recently announce? They have paid developers $15 billion or something like that. I didn't know that scale would happen. I figured there would be some scale, but I just thought that it wouldn't be nearly the size that it is now. I did not think that, or I did not foresee that smartphones would represent a very large, now greater than desktop online traffic. I did not see at first, I'm going back to 2008 now, I did not see that it would be the commerce king that it is. I figured it'd be like really great for like news and entertainment, but you have to realize that in the first week in 2007 that Apple launched the iPhone, I think they sold 250,000 units. Now, when they launch a new iPhone, if it's not 5 million, it's a bad day. So there's now over 1 billion devices per platform of the two major platforms. And now roughly the same tools we use to build apps for phones, we're now building apps for television, for connected devices. I didn't see the full ecosystem coming. I saw the single screen in front of me, and that was enough to get me excited to move forward. And then what opened up were all these other opportunities. And, you know, Steve Jobs had lots of great quotes. One of them is, you can't see the dots connecting into the future, but when you look backwards, they all make sense. When you look backwards in your life and you connect all the dots, well, I moved here, then I met this person, then I got this job, then I did this and I did that, and this other thing happened to me that was really bad, and then that opened a chance to meet this person who became my spouse or whatever. It makes all the sense. Well, of course that happened. But when you look forward, you can't necessarily see the dots connected. So I believe you just have to have the faith to lean forward at all times. You don't have to like thrust yourself into the deep end. Just lean forward, but do it every day. Don't like pull back. That's what a lot of people do. They pull back. They pull back. We are our greatest self-limiters. There's other things that are also trying to limit us, other external forces, but no force is greater than our own selves in limiting ourselves. And if you can just pull back the strength of your own limiters, then you can lean into something. You don't have to go all in or freak everybody out, just lean in. And I guarantee you, if you lean in every single day, you will look back and be like, oh my gosh, now I see how all those dots connected. So yeah, if you look backwards, there's a shit ton of stuff that I didn't see coming. But I lean forward every day, so I wasn't surprised when it happened. So now today, when something else opens up to us, I don't go, oh my gosh. I say, oh my gosh, this is great. Let's go for this too. Let's go for that too. So I really think it's less about what you found surprising looking backwards and more about what you're looking forward to going forwards.
You mentioned you didn't foresee what mobile apps could do for e-commerce. What have mobile apps done for e-commerce in your opinion?
So the great thing is mobile is outstripping a lot of other venues for buying things. And that's terrific, not just because I'm in the business of elevating those experiences, facilitating those experiences, building those experiences, optimizing those experiences. And a lot of stuff we do now rings to cash register, you know, whether it be booking and, you know, your flights or paying for your hotel room or buying products, whether they be digital products or physical products. The really cool thing about the mobile device is it is very, very powerful at a few things. Number one, mobile is really good at making something personal and personalization. So that's great because the more the device can help you have a more just made for you buying, shopping, the pathway to purchase, if you would. If I can make that more good for you, then you're going to be happier. You're going to be more comfortable. And you're more likely to convert and get what you want. Not just buy more crap, but get what you want. The other thing is it is, if content is king, then context is queen. Context is so important and so just done so well with mobile. So I can understand where you are. I mean, to the point that based on the vibrations of the phone, I could tell, I know how to tell, that you're driving, you're walking, I know where you are, I know what the temperature is, I know if you're at home or at work, obviously all with permissions. And so I can provide a great context for you. So if you're the kind of person that wakes up at 10:30 and has breakfast, and you usually have lunch around 1:30, I can talk to you in your semantic time. I can talk to you about swinging by in, you know, a Starbucks drive-thru at 10:30, not 6:30. And then just like frictionless and convenience, like the work we did with Starwood, where we literally took the check-in out of the check-in experience, where you walk into a Starwood hotel, you get push notification telling you what your room number is. We tell you, because people don't believe it, no, you really can just walk to your room now. You hold your phone up to the door lock and the door lock opens. I mean, mind blown. That is so cool. That is taking so much friction out of the experience where people are used to showing up at a hotel room, standing in a damn line for 10 minutes when they're tired and they just want to get to their room and they don't understand why they have to give their credit card anyways because they already gave it to reserve the room. So by taking that stuff out, those are the things, those three things, personalization, contextualization, and convenience / frictionless, those are three things that no other technology, platform, etc. can do on the planet Earth better than mobile, at least for what we have right now.
What does your day-to-day schedule look like now compared to in the beginning?
In the beginning, I'd wake up late and my now twin 9-year-old girls were born the same year the company was born. And so there would have been family time during the day with the kids at such a young age. But I would spend a lot of time, because I was the project manager, I was also QA, did a lot of testing. I would get all the overnight builds together, run testing for hours, kind of see where projects sat, have two or three sessions with myself where I was at a Starbucks for 4 or 5 hours alone, sketching an app idea. There was a lot of reflective alone time. I was physically alone, but I was connected to a handful of people that were all working in this concert, you know, an orchestrated effort. And then I would usually work till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And so were the other people. That's just how we rolled. And we'd be Skyping at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, which kind of worked out because, again, my baby girls were in the next room and they would wake up all the time. And so I had a chance to help them out too. But now it's, I wake up a lot earlier. I walk into the office, and unless it's an unusual day, my time is split usually 15, 30 minute or 1 hour chunks, and it's back to back. And it's usually meetings with others, helping to unblock things, helping to add ideas or add perspective to things. I'd like to think that whatever 10 years of a lot of overtime adds up to, that those numbers of hours has over time given me a level of kind of like natural intuitiveness on what opportunities there are to build something, and then what insight do we have that we can pick the right thing. So for example, it might be the big idea of sitting down with the brand and trying to figure out what's the highest and best use of their brand on mobile. Let's say they're building something that's going to be e-commerce oriented, and I could maybe help them figure out like the experience that they can own, something that's authentic and not a me too and not a lookalike experience, but something that is remarkable and unique and ownable by that brand, an ownable experience. So I get the opportunity to still work in that area. But for the most part, I've been really blessed in collecting a lot of great people who absolutely love the same thing I do and love doing it day in and day out.
People often look past or never see where successful entrepreneurs may have failed. Can you make us feel a little better? And how have you failed, Calvin?
Sure. How much time you got? So I'll first start by saying that we have a bunch of traditions here. Traditions and rituals or cadence and things like that are very important to culture. In culture, at the end of the day, is the most important thing. In culture, eats business strategy for breakfast. So I truly believe that strong cultures can transcend obstacles and hardships and things like that. So if a leader, an entrepreneur, wants to go at it without thinking about culture, culture's still an important thing. It just might not be something they work on. And by definition, they're going to have to work so hard in other areas because they didn't work on culture. But if you will go with me for a second and just say, listen, yeah, you're right, Calvin, culture is super important. Part of the thing that I think is important is that every new Rocketeer have the same experience that every other new Rocketeer has. So there's like immediate similarity in the experience. They all have something that, an experience that they've shared. It's kind of like the concept of boot camp in the military, I guess. And so we have this thing called flight school. Part of flight school, I talk about the power and the importance of passion here at Bottle Rocket. And I talk about our purpose, talk about our values. And then I go on to talk a lot about failure. And a lot about the importance of failure. There's a lot of cliches, and I'm about to say stuff now that you probably see on those like posters where a cat's hanging from a bar or something, but cliches are cliches for a reason. You do, in fact, become more of who you are from the hardships or failures in your life than you do from the things that just kind of were easier in your life. You really do get to know a person a lot more in tough situations when everything's falling apart than how they act when everything is going great. So I like to talk about inviting failure into your life. And I sometimes I'll say like, imagine a life in which you invited failure into your home every day. I want to mess something up at least a little bit every day. Because if I am messing something up just a little bit, that means I must be trying something or doing something that I haven't done a million times in the past, which means you're growing. The basic concept of exercise, I understand it. I've only heard from my friends about exercise, is you have to break down a muscle to be able to make it stronger. The same thing has to go with your whole body, your whole self, is you have to have those moments where you're humbled, where you stop and really take in the fact that you don't know everything and you are a learning person. I think people, when they become experts, and we work really hard to employ a lot of experts here, I think traditionally expertise comes with a lot of ego. And if you're the kind of person that thinks that you know it all, you're not going to get a job at Bottle Rocket, even if you, quote unquote, do know it all, which is impossible, because we're hiring for much more than just the know-how, because the know-how is just knowing how to do it today. Know-how changes constantly. So I think that if I look back on the failures, and if you just keep it to the last 9 years, because there's a lot more going back to my total of 46 years, I think that I made some hiring mistakes along the way that pulled us backwards instead of pulled us forwards. I made some mistakes in some promotions, promoting people to a level at which they really weren't able to be set up for success. And it's always rough when you promote someone because you really appreciate the work that they've done so far. And so it's almost as a form of gratitude, you give someone a promotion, because a promotion is perceived as like a ubiquitous good thing, but it's not always. And you can unfortunately promote someone to a position where they just don't have something that it takes to be successful at that position. And that's tough, because then you realize the blood is really on your hands. It's really not on the other person's hands. And so that's, I'd say, one other big thing. I think another one is, you know, I don't think that we have necessarily taken advantage of the massive disruption that happened in a few industries. We're a little light on CPG. We do some really great CPG work, don't get me wrong, but I think we could have done a lot more. But there are some groups that specialize in that area. And so there's areas and there's industries that we're not as strong in because we didn't capture the market as early on as we may have in a lot of the other areas that we do an enormous amount of business in. So I think that there are some things that, if I look backwards, like, well, why didn't we just go after more of that work? Why didn't we insert ourselves in opportunities that way? And then I'd say that on top of all those things, I think that even though I think I did a decent job of letting go of things along the way, I think that there are a lot of things that I still let go too slow, that I didn't honor someone else's ability by just letting them run with it. And I can think of a few right now which I won't share on this public media, where I held someone back too long. And by holding that person back, I was sending them the message that I didn't trust them, even though I did. Maybe it was more about me than them. And if I could go back and change it, I would, because I know they would have just taken it and run with it and done a much better job than I was holding on to it.
What are you excited about right now?
What's really exciting for me is something that, you know, I call ambient experiences. So if you go back really far, and let's go as far as the Macintosh, 1984. Here is this like mind-blowing machine where you can put your hand on a mouse and move it around. And when you moved around, that mouse was connected to a cord, and that cord to the computer, and the computer had a screen on it. And it had this little arrow. And as you move the mouse, the pointer moved. And then you could move that pointer over like a picture of a button that says zoom. And then you could click the zoom button and the photograph on the screen would zoom in. Like that was like, oh my God, that's huge. You know, now or a few years ago, whatever, when the iPhone came out, you would put your fingers on directly onto that photograph. And you would pinch your fingers out to zoom or move your fingers out to zoom in. So you were taking away abstraction layers. So if you think about, like, you look at a button, you click on it to make the photo get bigger, and you're moving this thing with your hand, all those different separations between you and the thing you want to interact with. So now you have things like AR and VR, but also voice, which is getting more and more connected to the initial intent. And so if you get to the point where you can speak what you want, think what you want, or do a visual gesture with your eyes, or a gesture with your hand that's touching nothing, but nothing real. There's less and less layers between the human and the thing they want to make happen using technology. That gets really exciting for guys like me, because I get really excited about moving a picture with your fingers, And imagine what's more natural than just speaking, like just talking here. You and I would think of no other way of communicating other than just speaking naturally to one another. So the technology is getting us closer and closer, and voice has finally hit a point of accuracy and will over the next 3 years of 1 or 2 more percent in accuracy, and we're there. I think we're like, I think Mary Meeker PowerPoint done about a year and a half ago was, I think we were at like 96% accuracy, and I could be off by a percentage point. But when you hit like 98, you're kind of done. You're like, you're there enough where people would rely on it and trust it. Of course, it's one of those exponential curves. It's harder and harder to get that extra 1%. But we're at the point where voice is a sure thing. This artificial intelligence, which is so overused, it's ridiculous. But the core concept of AI has such amazing promise. And I'm kind of frustrated by a lot of the hype that goes with AI, because I think people naturally avoid doing serious things that get hype around it. They'll do experimental things, so the hype will go away, and then real AI uses and applications will still be here. So, and that in itself brings things more human and more natural. And AR and VR, the ability to interact with things, virtual things in physical space and vice versa, and increasing the physicality, the more you move your body and to make natural gestures that you're used to manipulating the real world with, doing that in a virtual world is very exciting. I know that some people listening to this will think like, oh yeah, that's a bunch of sci-fi, but it's not. Everything that's real today was sci-fi either a few years ago or a decade ago. Even I, who was a fanboy of this device and what it has in the ecosystem that has produced what we have today, even I didn't see 10 years ago where we would be today. So I don't expect anyone not in this business to not see 10 years forward. I just have the faith that we're going to get there with the experiences that make our lives better, more rich, more full, and more human. I think you're going to see human-computer interfaces that seem more human and less computer, because they're going to be more and more based on natural gestures and natural inputs like voice and our ability to listen, reason, process, and respond. And that just gets really exciting. It's really exciting. And I'm a little jealous of people who are being born just right now, because they're going to see a lot more of it than I will.
Bottle Rocket now employs more than 250 people and currently has more than 300 iOS, Android, streaming device, wearable, AR and VR, voice, and TV apps. Chances are you have or probably will experience one of their apps in the future. You can learn more about Bottle Rocket at bottlerocketstudios.com. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Join us next episode as Laura Diasaro, a co-founder of the snack food company Chirps, tries to get us to eat bugs. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, and you can also listen on Stitcher as well as at podomatic.com.